Hello and welcome. Speaking to Legends podcast. This show is a quest for ideas, insights, and stories from the lives of the most successful hedge fund managers. We learn about their spectacular careers, we share their life lessons, and dissect their investment techniques. We're thrilled by the prospect of sharing educational and thought-provoking content which helps you learn, grow, and think. If you like the show and find it useful, please support it by subscribing and writing a review on iTunes. Help us spread the word and grow the show by sharing it with a friend or two. The legend of today is Professor David Hunt. He's Emeritus Professor of Mathematics and Senior Research Investigator at Imperial College London. He has published 300 scientific papers and 30 books, won many prestigious awards, and was a president of the Royal Statistics Society. During this interview, Professor David Hunt explains what is dark data, why this simple but highly influential concept is widely overlooked, what is the edge of the most successful quant hedge funds, and why statistics is fundamentally different to mathematics. Let's get right into it. Hello, Professor David Hunt. It's really a great pleasure of ours to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. Thank you.
Let's kick it off by learning more about your background. Where did you go to school and when did maths and statistics caught your attention? What sparked your interest?
My parents traveled around quite a lot when I was young, but I spent most of my teenage years in a town on the south coast of Britain called Bournemouth. And I think when I was sort of young teenager, I was a science fiction enthusiast, reading all the classic authors, you know, Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, all these sorts of people. And, you know, I had great ideas of what the future would bring. Of course, nobody ever predicted the internet, but that's something different. And in those days, computers were just basically being invented. The transistor was invented in 1948. I was born in 1950. So it shows, 10, 15 years on, computers starting to be invented with sort of magnetic rings for storing bits of information and so on. So it was a very sort of exciting time. And I got interested in computers. I wasn't especially interested in mathematics at that stage, but I got interested in computers. The electronic brains and so on is the sort of terms that was used in those days. And of course, Isaac Asimov with robots and so on. So I got interested in that sort of thing. And it became clear to me that in order to understand computers, computers were based on mathematics of various kinds. So I had to study mathematics and became more interested in that. And then gradually, as I got older, I had to make decisions about what direction I wanted to go. Did I want to go to the arts or the sciences or whatever? And what might I do in the future? And I had no idea what I wanted to do for a living, as it were. So I decided to do a degree in maths on the grounds that that's deferring decisions. Maths underpins so many things that I still didn't have to make a decision. I put the decision off. I've basically been doing that all my life. During my maths degree, I didn't really study any statistics. I remember I did one course on probability and one course on statistics. And the statistics course didn't mention the word data or anything like that. It was all from the sort of mathematical perspective. But then in my final year, I can remember talking to my tutor. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I put off making decisions by doing a maths degree. Still didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I'd specialized in mathematical physics in my last year. And I can remember my tutor saying, well, you can either go on. I wanted to continue studying. I wanted to continue deferring the decision. I can remember him saying, well, you can carry on studying mathematical physics, or you might think about doing statistics, because if you do statistics, you'll be able to get a job, which was quite enlightened of him, I think, because it wasn't so obvious in those days that statistics was so universally important. So I think that was an interesting suggestion of his. Now, of course, since I'd studied so little statistics during my maths degree, I didn't know what statistics was. I assumed it was probability theory, basically. But I decided to follow his advice, and thinking that one day I'd probably want to get a job, I decided to do an MSc in statistics. And I went to Southampton University to do an MSc in statistics. And then I stayed on, deferring decisions again, still, and did a PhD in, it was in pattern recognition, and it was in an electronics department, but it was really non-parametric multivariate statistics. So I sort of, in some sense, as I think quite a lot of people, drifted into statistics and data science. The PhD was a sort of combination of statistics, machine learning, AI, that sort of very much at the interface of those areas. So I drifted into it is the answer to your question, and I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, it's funny how this idea of just postponing the decision kind of led you find your passion, and the fact that you sticked around and pursued and pretty much dedicated your whole life just goes to show that it actually worked out pretty well for you.
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. There's an important lesson to be learned from that. Don't rush into anything unless you're sure about it, because, you know, you can take your time to make the right decision.
Yeah, it's sort of almost easier to understand what doesn't work for you rather than know what works.
Very good point. Yeah. I think that's right. Yes. I wasn't very good at mathematics, but I was quite good at statistics. And I always think of these two disciplines as fundamentally different. Clearly, mathematics underpins statistics and data science. But mathematics, I describe as, this is a caricature, but the basic principle is you start with some axioms and you deduce the consequences of those axioms. So in a sense, you're saying, this is what the world is like. Now let's see what sort of data are generated by this world. Statistics goes in the opposite direction. Statistics starts with the data and says, what sort of world might have produced those data? So that in some sense, the two things are going in opposite directions.
Yeah, absolutely. As you kind of go to the lowest level to axioms, it makes it rather obvious the difference between the two, because these days it's quite easy to get caught up in all of this, you know, alternative data, big data, artificial intelligence, like all of this terminology, which in practical sense have like almost perfect intersection and it's difficult to distinguish for those that are special, like not full-time in the space. Continuing our journey throughout your life, so how did your passion for research evolve as you went through your PhD program and started teaching? Any illustrative stories you want to share?
I suppose my passion for learning has always been there. I was always wanted to learn new things. It didn't have to be research. I didn't have to discover it for myself. Maybe reading someone else's discovery would have been just as good, probably related to the sort of early enthusiasm for science fiction and so on. So I had a sort of wish to understand things. I suppose there's this sort of 10,000 hours thing. The more you focus on something, the more you study it, the better you get at it. And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true for statisticians. You know, there's a sort of classic sort of story that mathematicians do their best work when they're very young. I think for statisticians, they do their best work older, maybe not when they're very old, but older, because I think because statistics necessarily involves some sort of understanding of the world, the real world out there, the more you know about that, the more you're able to make sensible decisions about what the data are telling you. Plus, of course, there's also the fact that different areas of statistics and data science, they're all interconnected. So learning about something in statistics in medicine, for example, means you can probably apply the same ideas in finance and or in manufacturing or whatever. So I think that's one of the things that I had a wish to understand, and learning more and more and more, sort of there was a synergistic effect, got more and more enthusiastic about it. And I think that also applies to solving problems. The more ways you can look at things, the more you have seen in the past, you're better at solving problems. And I think the key lesson there is probably to look at things from as many different angles as possible. If you're very constrained tunnel vision, it's tough to solve problems. But if you can get outside and say, well, you can look at it this way, look at it that way, and that's probably something I've learned. One other lesson I've learned is from my sort of years of teaching, the best way to understand something is to teach it. If you've got a bunch of students out there asking you searching questions, you really have to get to grips with the subject. And certainly that was true for, I taught a course in stochastic processes. My limited studies early on meant I'd never taken a formal course in stochastic processes. So I had to get a whole lot of books on it and really get to grips with it. The best way to make sure you understand something is to teach it. And I can remember some of the students, the first year I taught it, very searching questions, which really did make sure that forced me to make sure I knew what I was talking about.
It's an interesting parallel that you're making, that like for mathematics, it's a lot about kind of being creative. And perhaps in the earlier days, when like people are like in 30s, 40s, they are much, much more creative. While when they get older, like for statistics, you actually rely a lot more on the wisdom and some of this insights that you picked up about the world, and you're kind of applying them to your research. I think that's an interesting observation and insight.
I think it is. The philosopher Thomas Kuhn has got the structure of scientific revolutions person. He's got some interesting things to say about this. He, in fact, says it's not how old you are that counts. It's how recently you entered the area that you're working on. So one should change disciplines every 10, 20 years or something, because you then bring novel perspectives, you're learning new things and so on.
Over the years, you published 300 scientific papers, 28 books on topics in finance, statistics, machine learning, and had quite a profound impact on the development of these disciplines. What motivates you, like as a researcher, and drives you as a scholar? Is it this passion for knowledge, or for sharing, for discovering? What is it that drives you?
It's 30 books now. Your two books out of date. What drives me? Well, I think the key driver is what we were talking about earlier. It's the desire to understand things, the wish to discover new things, or even if I'm not discovering them myself, I'm just reading about them, and to understand things, put things together, understand how things work. I think that can be a bit of a problem sometimes, because I there's so much out there to understand. I think I sometimes spread myself too thinly. You know, I might be better off if I focused down more. But as for the 300 papers and 30 books, I think I've been very lucky. Unlike many academics and researchers, I enjoy writing, which is why I've written so much. Many people enjoy the research, but when it comes to writing it up, they find that a tremendous effort, a tremendous burden. I've seen this with PhD students who enjoy the research, and then you really have to force them back to it to make sure they actually write up the thesis effectively at the end. And I think I was lucky because I enjoy writing. If I hadn't become a statistician, maybe I would have become a writer. Well, I already have become a writer, I suppose, but in a different sense. It's the desire to understand, and there's nothing better than feeling that you've seen something, which can be in theory or it can be in data, that nobody else has seen before. I sometimes describe statisticians and data scientists as like Victorian explorers. They're going up to the source of the Amazon or something. We're doing exactly the same thing, but our world is a world of data. But if you've got a new data set, it is an unexplored world. People haven't seen it before, and you can find things in there that no one has seen before. And that's such a kick when you say, hey, look, there's this pattern, there's this structure, there's this relationship. Then it's tremendous, tremendous kick.
It's almost like competition. So a bunch of different people are looking at the same data and applying new methodologies, techniques. And there are so many degrees of freedom where this wisdom that you mentioned allows you to develop your edge and to take out some valuable insights of the data that other researchers could easily miss. What is your take on this?
That's a very, very interesting point. As you were saying it, I thought of the analogy between that, the sort of meta-level thing, and building statistical models for a set of data. building statistical models. You could build a deep learning neural network, some highly non-parametric thing with billions of parameters, no constraints at all. Or you could say, well, I believe this kind of a linear model or some kind of highly constrained model is more appropriate. Now, based on your previous experience, you might have an idea for what model for. Maybe it should be a mixture distribution or whatever. You have some idea. Now, the first kind of model, the deep learning, highly parameterized model, very flexible, can fit any set of data, but is fundamentally brittle. It's non-robust. You change the data a bit, it could produce a completely different kind of model. So it has advantages and disadvantages. The other angle where you come in and say, well, I've seen things like this before, it's probably a mixture model. If you're right and it is a mixture model, then you've got very few parameters to estimate and you can estimate them accurately. So you get very good results. But of course, if your initial ideas are wrong, then you've got a biased model so that you get poor predictions. So I think there are pros and cons to each of them. But I think it's exactly analogous to what you were saying. A younger person with no, having seen nothing like this before, might come in and try all sorts of things, doesn't know what. So high variance, but low bias in what they're doing. An older person, having seen similar things in the past, might say, try this, so that they have low variance because they've constrained the model for, they've regularized, they've smoothed it in some sense. But of course, if they're wrong, then they've got high bias. I think it's exactly the same sort of situation in the data analytic world as in the sort of meta world that you're talking about. Yeah, interesting.
So would you agree to this if I kind of summarize it as maybe as you get more experienced and well-rounded as an individual, you just at the start have a more informed prior as opposed to somebody that new to it?
Yes, that's a nice sort of Bayesian way of putting it. And that, I think that's absolutely right. And that sums it up nicely. And if your prior is right, that gives you a tremendous help when you're fitting the model and so on. And if your prior is wrong, then you're going to get biased results and so on. So that's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
Putting this academic research that you accumulated over so many years, you took a number of advisory roles, and there is one particular one that I would want to dive a little bit deeper on. So you spent over 8 years as a chief scientific advisor at Winton Capital Management, which is one of the world's largest quantitative hedge funds. What were your responsibilities at that firm, and how did this experience of a practical application of these techniques shape you as a researcher?
I suppose throughout my career, I'd always wanted to solve problems that other people cared about rather than problems that interested me and nobody else in the world was interested in. So I'd always done a lot of consultancy work in the past, collaborating with all sorts of industries, but it was all always very much while I was an academic. In the case of Winton, I took initially I took a 2-year sabbatical to go and work there, but I found it very interesting, so I stayed on for a total of 8 years in the end, 4 years full time and then followed by 4 years part time. So it was full on. At the time I went there, well, at the time I left, there were 150 researchers. Gradually the numbers built over time. 150 researchers. And basically my job, my role was to talk to all of the researchers, not all at once, one at a time, and make sure they were up to date with statistical machine learning AI developments, make sure they knew what was particularly pertinent, appropriate for the kinds of problems that they were trying to solve. And then if they had particularly challenging issues, to help them find solutions, help them resolving those technical problems of data analysis. And it was very, very exciting. I wouldn't have stayed there 8 years if it hadn't been exciting. But it was exciting, I think, for two reasons. One was wonderful data sets, massive data sets, and not just financial market data, but all sorts of data, you know, data of goods being moved across the world, satellite photographs of crops, all sorts of data sets. So all sorts of different challenging areas of statistics. So the data set, and of course, being Winton Capital, it could afford to buy any of the data it wanted. It wasn't constrained, as many academics are, by you know, if a data set cost £1 million, fine. If it was important, we would buy it. So that was one of the things, the data. And the other was the technical statistical challenges, the problems that they had, which were really technically very tough and very, very interesting. Actually, I can remember early on, maybe first or second year I was there, I was at a client conference, investors conference, and a group of Japanese came up to me, Japanese investors came up to me and said, what do you like working about Winton? Your question, really. And I said, it's wonderful. They've got all sorts of problems. And they looked at me and said, Winton has problems? I quickly backed, you know, challenges, statistical challenges. So that was the other thing, that on the one hand, the data, and on the other, the interesting statistical challenges. So let me give a very simple example. So I'd done a lot of work I spent 10 years at the Institute of Psychiatry early on in my career. So I'd worked with social scientists of various kinds and psychologists and so on. They will use regression analysis. And let me take a step back further. I was originally, as I said, interested in mathematical physics, and physicists will use regression analysis. And they might fit a curve to a set of data points, and they might spot slight deviations from linearity, from a straight line. They might spot a slight curvature and estimate the curvature. The reason they can do that is because the measurement error is pretty small compared with the signal in many situations. It's a bit of a caricature, but that's the principle. Then when I worked with all these social scientists, they would also use regression analysis, but they wouldn't try to spot the magnitude of a slight deviation from a straight line, because their error variation, the measurement error in the social sciences, is much greater. The best they can do is spot that it's proportion of variation explained. They can try to talk about the slope of a straight line if you approximate the data by a straight line. But then when I went to Winton, this measurement error had increased yet further. Now the measurement error was going up through the roof and down through the floor. You know, it was huge measurement error relative to the signal, because they're trying to spot tiny little signals. So they would use regression analysis, but it would be, again, used in a different way, used for a different purpose from the natural sciences like physics, the social sciences like psychology. They would be using it in a different way. So new kinds of statistical challenges. So it's expanding me as well as, I hope, me helping Winton.
Seems like you really enjoyed solving those problems that investors were very frightened to hear about. Seems like different people have different types of problems. And some are actually good, make you learn, make you try. I think you would be in a really good position to answer this question. So there were a couple of books over the past years released, which really focused on some of the cultural aspects that some of these most successful hedge funds built on. And in this case, I'm mostly talking about Renaissance Technologies. If you listen to some of the founders, most of them, if not all of them, are describing their firms, at least when they were, you know, smaller and less, not so many layers of management and so on, but as a just academic, like a campus where it's really research-driven, scientific organization. And so given your roles in Imperial College and in other organizations and this practical hands-on experience at Winton, what is your kind of take on this? Is the edge, in a sense, that these companies are getting, is it coming from the setup that they build around how they do the research? Or is it really this deeper insights and data and those kind of things? It's probably not a clear-cut answer, but what's your thinking of this?
I think that's a very perceptive question. Yes, certainly. When I went to Winton, its culture was scientific. They were basically a scientific organization trying to make discoveries in data. I'd done consultancy work for some of the big investment banks in the past, and it was okay doing consultancy work for them, but I would never have wanted to go and work for them, because certainly at the time I found the culture not the sort of culture where I would like to work. But Winton was a scientific organization. It was trying to make discoveries in data. And that's what interested me in it. And, you know, as I've been describing, the sorts of my role was to help make scientific discoveries. So it was very much like an academic research institution. The big difference being that you didn't publish, but you still had the joy of making and the fun of making the discoveries. And I think that's absolutely right in the sort of in those days. And Rentec it was same sort of thing, really, trying to understand what's going on in data. And then as a second wave, once you've understood what's going on in data, you can see if you can use that to build an effective trading system. But in some sense, that wasn't the original motivation. I mean, that's the bottom line, but that wasn't what the data scientists were doing.
Yeah, very interesting. It's so important to align all of the interests in order to sustain this longer term growth for these organizations. It's like so many again variables that you need to think through and like try to optimize, because otherwise, this research can be quite dangerous.
And it also has to be said, I think, that you get the best researchers, the people who are most likely to make good discoveries, if you make it a conducive research environment. I mean, let's face it, the organizations like Winton and Rentec are trying to attract people from academic institutions. And people are working in academic institutions, not for the money, but because of the joy of discovery. So if you're going to try to recruit them, yes, you're going to pay them more, but that's not what really drives them. What drives them, what motivates them, is the joy of discovery. So you've got to give them an environment where that exists.
Yeah, I think in one of the previous questions, you summarized it really well, like what drives you. And this is kind of exactly what attracted you to Winton. So it makes lots of sense. And so going further with your academic career and your publications, so leveraging some of these insights and the experiences that you accumulated throughout these years, you recently published a book that's called Dark Data. Can you please, in just simple terms, explain what is dark data and why it is important to understand it?
So every day in the newspapers, there are sort of gushing eulogies about the power of modern data science and AI, how it's going to revolutionize the human condition. All of those stories hide something fundamental. They hide the painful truth that data are almost always incomplete or inaccurate or approximate or misleading or perhaps even wrong. Those sorts of things are what I call dark data. I'll explain more in a minute. But what they mean is that your conclusions can be mistaken. You can get things wrong. If your conclusions are mistaken, the decisions you take, the actions you take, they can be wrong as well. And I have many examples in the book. So in a sense, dark data are data you don't have. Now, that might be because you want today's data, but all you've got is yesterday's. Today's hasn't occurred yet, so you can't collect it. It might be because you've got a selected sample. You haven't got all of the data, you've just got some of the data. And perhaps the sum of the data you've got has been chosen in a particular way. Okay, if it's a nice random sample, but maybe it's just people who volunteered to give you their data. So it might be distorted and not representative. Your data might be dark because the recorded values are inaccurate and from no measuring instrument is perfect. We're seeing this at the moment with all the publicity about testing for COVID. All medical tests have false positives and false negatives, even if they tell you otherwise. That's not true because there's always humans in the loop. So they have no measurement instrument is perfect. The data might be dark because you've only got averages, summary values. That tells you nothing about the extremes. It doesn't tell you about skewness and so on. It might even be because your data might be dark even because you've got it, but it's, or at least you can get access to it, but it's not examined. So you might have data in a giant warehouse that you collected because the regulatory authorities said you must collect it for compliance reasons, but nobody's ever looked at it. So all of these are examples of dark data. In some sense, they're data you don't have. And not being aware of what you don't have or not knowing what missing values are, for example, means that you can make catastrophically wrong decisions. And that's what I talk about in the book. I give many examples of how decisions have gone wrong, actions have gone wrong, sometimes with people losing vast fortunes or even people dying. And I talk in a book, I give 15 different types of dark data, but there are other types of, new kinds of data are coming along all the time. Unstructured data, image data, signal data, scanner data, web scraping data are recent new types. New types will occur tomorrow. Each new type has its own kinds of risks of different kinds of dark data. And I can give you many examples of this. Here's a little example. 20 years ago, measles killed about 1 million people a year. The disease of measles killed about 1 million people a year. But then vaccines were developed. Now it only kills about 100,000 people a year. Somebody might think about, say, well, I've never known anybody killed with measles. I've never known, none of my friends have died or family have died of measles. I don't believe it's dangerous as you think, and therefore I'm not going to be vaccinated, because they're missing data, information on what happens if people aren't vaccinated. This is another kind of dark data. It's counterfactual data. What would happen if you did something different? But measles is particularly pernicious because it's recently been discovered that measles damages the immune system. So for every person who dies of measles, it's thought that about four times as many die of something else that they wouldn't have died of if their immune system hadn't been damaged by the measles. So another kind of dark data, measles is killing five times as many people as you think because of the damage to the immune system. Gradually, that's being discovered and unearthed, and people are learning what's going on there. So gradually, the data, a light is being shone on the data, but it's taking time. So dark data, basically data you don't have of one kind. It might be non-response in a survey, and you can see the blank. They didn't give their age. You can see that's blank. But it might be because, think of people not replying to a web survey. You might not know who could possibly reply. You might not know if people have replied more than once. So that's a different kind of dark data, much more difficult kind, because you can't look at it and say, there's a missing value there.
It's funny how this simple idea is perhaps quite often misunderstood and can lead you to drastically different conclusions. And in the age of big data, there are more problems than with a small data set. Because big ones, they have all of the problems of the small data set plus some more. Maybe you can just expand a little bit on this one.
I think the fundamental problem with big data is that you can't look at all the data. When I first learned statistics a long time ago, a big data set might have been 1,000 data points. And you can look at each of 1,000 data points. You can say, is there something funny about this one? You can plot it this way, plot it that way, look at it in all sorts of different angles. You can really go to town on familiarizing yourself with the data. But if you've got 1 billion data points, there are only 32 million seconds in a year. So if you've got 1 billion data points, you can't look at them all one at a time. This means you have to rely on the computer. And the computer, if you like, it's a window to the data, but it's also a window between you and the data. It only allows you certain angles, certain perspectives on the data. And that means that you can miss crucial things about the data. And that's a particular problem with very large data sets.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure you've encountered lots of these problems, and they're not so new as you were kind of going through your journey. But would you say that there is any difference, or there are any specific problems to finance, or is it kind of quite similar across disciplines?
Yeah, I think each discipline has its own particular kinds of dark data, but dark data can occur in many different ways. So you will also find the same kinds occurring in different disciplines. I mean, obviously, so in clinical trials, people drop out. You're giving the treatment to people, and they might stop turning up for the appointments. So you don't know whether they got better or not. They dropped out. And it might be in clinical trials that the people who got better tended to drop out preferentially. The people who didn't get better stayed in the trial, for all you know. So that if you didn't take that into account, you get a distorted impression of how effective the treatment was. Now, in the financial sector, you have the same sort of problem. You might have a a fund, and you might be which might be composed of a number financial streams from a number share prices from a number of different companies. The ones which perform badly might be dropped from your fund, so that you would get, if you didn't take that into account, you would get a distorted impression of how your fund was doing, or how the index, how an index was doing, if you don't take into account the ones that have dropped out as well. So dropouts and so on can affect both of these areas, but every different area will also have its own particular class of problems, of dark data problems.
What are perhaps some practical steps of incorporating dark data in quantitative research and how to enhance the decision-making through understanding the dark data?
Those are the key questions, of course. And the second half of the book sort of goes into how the first part of the book is sort of talking about different kinds of dark data and the sorts of problems that can arise. And the second half basically goes into what you can do about it, how you can try to overcome the problems. I suppose the first step is, actually the very first step, is to recognize that your data probably aren't perfect. Just because it's connected or collected automatically by a trading system, a trading exchange, or an electronic measuring instrument, doesn't mean it's perfect. Communication channels can go down, instruments can fail, all sorts of things can happen that you don't expect. Anybody who's worked in the financial industry with trading systems will recognize all sorts of glitches can occur. Timestamps can be misplaced at the wrong time, all sorts of things. So the first step is to be suspicious. Recognize that your data, you might think your data are perfect, but it probably isn't. There may be all sorts of problems that you haven't thought of lurking there, so be suspicious. Then dig down deeper, understand what you might be missing about your data, why it might not be perfect, and of course, how you might be being misled because of what you're not aware of. And then, of course, once you know what sort of things might be missing, what might be obscured within the data, understand why it's missing, what mechanism have gone on to produce that. So, for example, referring to my earlier sort of illustrations, if certain classes of people or objects, systems, funds, whatever, have been differentially, preferentially selected out, understand that. Because if you understand the selection process, the mechanism through which the data are chosen and distorted and so on, then you can start to try to build ways to overcome that. You can try to overcome the misleading impression of partial data sets and so on. And depending upon the way in which the data are dark, there are different tools that you can apply for tackling the problems. And the book goes into, in a non-mathematical way, the book describes some of the tools for tackling these problems. Dark data is fundamentally a problem. If there's something about the data you don't understand, you might be being misled by it. So one really needs to tackle that and overcome that. But it is possible also to use dark data to your advantage. I call this the strategic application of ignorance. So how you can use ignorance to your advantage. And if you think about it, we do this all the time in statistics. We use sampling. We get an estimate of an average from a population, perhaps not by finding every value in the population and averaging, but by drawing a sample of 1,000 points. Accountants do this sort of thing all the time, and social researchers do, even physicists do. Physicists, for example, working on the Large Hadron Collider, dramatically reduce the data sets that come in because they're so very massive. So sampling processes, in some sense, the way that's normally described, you say, well, I'm going to analyze 10% of the data. The dark data way of describing that is to say, well, I'm going to treat 90% of the data as dark. So you're using the idea of dark data to make the problem much more tractable. I can analyze 1,000 values quite easily. I can collect data on 1,000 people quite cheaply, whereas it could be much more expensive to collect data on 1,000,000 people. So we're using the idea of dark data to our advantage. And another example is double-blind randomized controlled trials, clinical trials in medicine, where you hide from the researchers and the patients the true treatment that they're receiving. Because if they knew what it was, there's a a very real risk of bias creeping in. If the doctors know who's going to receive the active treatment, they might direct it towards the more severely ill patients. And in fact, there are classic examples of exactly that sort of thing going on. But nowadays, these trials are blind, so people don't know what they're getting, and they're randomized. People are randomly allocated to the different arms of the trial. So you're hiding information, you're hiding data. So strategic application of ignorance. But actually, you can go further than that. Those are very familiar examples. But there are also, throughout data science, there are also less obvious ways of using this basic idea. So, for example, Monte Carlo methods, very widely used nowadays, especially with the sort of development of Bayesian methods. Essentially, what Monte Carlo methods do is they generate data that might have been. So they're generating data that were hidden from you, if you like. You didn't see it, but it could have occurred if your model's right. So you're generating data that might have been, dark data. Think about boosting in classification algorithms. This is a way of making the predictive performance of classification algorithms better. And the way it works is you apply a classification algorithm to a data set, and then you look at the ones cases it got wrong, and you double those numbers. You make copies of the ones it got wrong, and then you apply the algorithm again. This forces it to sort of focus attention preferentially on the ones it got wrong. And gradually, as you do this sequentially and iteratively, it gets better and better in its performance, classifying some of the ones it got wrong right next time. So you're creating data that might have been. You're making data sets, making data that you visible that you didn't see before. And you get the same thing with smoothing and regularization, which you can describe as creating copies of data similar to the data that you have got, perhaps jittery, slightly randomizing the data or whatever, and adding new copies of that to your original data set. So there are many of the tools that we use throughout data science and statistics we can think of as applications of this strategic application of ignorance of dark data.
It's really nice how you kind of summarize all of this and put it rather in simple terms. How such more or less easy idea conceptually becomes so powerful and so influential, and using the so first of all understanding dark data and then making the visible data and playing with it kind of increases model's robustness and multiplies your samples, which in some of the domains it's your most precious asset. The sample that you have, and with time series, I guess it's even more important. It's just quite often with financial time series that the data is not homogeneous and it changes all around, and there are different like structural shifts and so on.
I think that's right. I think the fundamental non-stationarity of the world we live in, and hence the financial time series, is a particular challenge of dark data, a particular source of dark data and a particular challenge. And this relates back to what we were talking about earlier. It's one of the things that made the work at Winton particularly interesting, because the world is fundamentally non-stationary.
Yeah. I have the final one for you. So what are the three pieces of advice would you give to your younger self?
I suppose the first thing I would have said, and this is a bit facetious, is, all right, you don't know what you want to do yet, but just hang on in there and you'll find something quite exciting. But that's not advice. My first piece of advice would be to take advantage of opportunities, grasp every opportunity that comes their way. In my earlier book, The Improbability Principle, I explained that there are people who are lucky, and those people are lucky because they give themselves more opportunities for fortunate things to happen to them. They grab opportunities, they go out there creating more scope for opportunities to happen to them. So I think that would be the first piece of advice. Make sure that you get out there, give yourself plenty of opportunities for good things to happen, and grasp those opportunities when they arise. Secondly, I think pursue things that you find interesting and fulfilling. I've been very lucky being an academic, I think, because I was able to pursue a particular area of research seemed particularly exciting to me. I was able to go for it. And I think, I would advise everybody to you've only got one life. Make sure that you do something that you enjoy. And then third, effort, I suppose. Even if something looks hard, if you work at it, you'll be able to do it. Mathematics has always struck me as hard, so I have to work at it, but I get there eventually. And I think that's important.
So persevering and maintaining laser focus is important, but at the same time, being open to new ideas, new opportunities, and every so often, every 10, 20 years, change the field to be creative.
Yes, I think that's right. I used to say, and I hadn't thought of this until you said that, Thomas Kuhn says that, that's right. And I always used to say, you should change jobs every 8 or 10 years, because not because you can do necessarily easily do everything in your current job, but because you will find new challenges which will expand your mind and so on.
Which will make you a better statistician.
Exactly, yes. Statistics is about bringing together ideas from various places. Yes.
I think we can go on for a lot more time, but I would like to round it up here. It was a great pleasure and big privilege to chat with you today. And this was very insightful and inspirational. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much indeed. I've enjoyed it immensely. Very good questions. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking to Legends. I hope you found it to be useful and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this show, please write a review on iTunes to support us. Stay tuned.